Good morning. This is Plan Well, Age Well, the second in a four-part series devoted to preparing for retirement and getting older. I'm Doug Nadvornik. This series was developed in conjunction with our partners, the Spokane Elder Resource Team. The team holds public workshops periodically to talk about a wide variety of issues. In fact, that's how we found out about it, as they were at the Spokane County Library District over a period of weeks. And the group is also planning some more later this month as a logical follow-up to our series of radio shows. We're going to talk today about senior housing options and legal issues tied to our later years. For example, if mom and dad can't live safely at home anymore, what are the places you might consider that involve part-time or full-time care, and how much do they cost? And how can you protect your assets so you don't go broke getting mom or dad into that place that's comfortable and safe? So we're taking phone calls this morning. Our phone number is 509-328-5877. We don't have the toll-free number this morning, but if you're calling from out of town, let us know and we'll get you on as quickly as we can. Or you can email our panelists a question, send it to Inland Journal, the name of our public affairs program, Inland Journal, one character, at kpbx.org, or post a question on the Spokane Public Radio Facebook page. So, finally, we get to our guests. In studio this morning, Kathy Bryant, a senior real estate specialist at EXL Realty, and Lynn St. Louis, founding partner of the Elder Law Group in Spokane. You can read more about them and about all of our guests this week at the Spokane Public Radio website. Click on the Plan Well, Age Well logo. Welcome, ladies. Good to talk with you.
Well, good morning. Welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
So we've got questions about housing. We've got questions about legal issues. So let's start. I wanted to start, Kathy, because a few years ago, a spokesman wrote a story about your personal story. Mm-hmm. And I will say that both of you are among the many folks who were interviewing this week who got into this through their own personal experience. So let's talk about you trying to find a place for your mother to live.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was quite the journey. My mother was aging. She was in a beautiful home, but the outside, the only way to get to it was concrete stairs. And she had to go up and down these concrete stairs every day to do her laundry, to get her car, to bring her groceries in. And initially, when she first moved in there, it was fine. But as she aged, she was getting older and weaker, and I was certain that it was time for her to move. And so I started the process of finding her someplace. And I went back and forth to communities and apartments and condos all over the city. And my mother, who is actually a very agreeable and sweet lady, really became quite the opposite. She had issue with every place I took her. It was either too dark, it was too small, windows, whatever. She had issue with it. Until one day when I found what I consider to be the perfect spot for her, that there shouldn't be any objections. So I took her home, back to her place, and I said, "That's a great place, Mom, isn't it? You know, what do you think?" And she goes, "Well, you know, I just think it's too dark." And I just threw up my hands and I said, "Mom, you're on your own." And I went back to my office, and I wasn't really mad at my mom at that moment. I was really mad at myself because I thought, how can I not help my mother? This is what I do for a living. I help people move, but I couldn't help my own mother. And I realized at that moment that this was really all about me. It wasn't about my mom. It was about me and my fear for my mom. I used to wake up in the middle of the night, absolutely certain she was going to fall down those stairs. So I wanted her to be someplace safe. Problem was, Mom didn't want to be there. She didn't see that she needed to move, and she didn't move. I finally realized what it was and realized the impact of moving from this longtime home that she actually loved, and that she wasn't ready to leave. And started my journey down the road of working with seniors and helping find resources and networking with people. How I met Lynn St. Louis over here was because of our networking and finding people who really specialize working with all of the issues that come along with moving from your longtime home. And it was pretty powerful. And that right now is my passion. It really helps me do my job in a way that I truly believe in.
So, Lynn, you've got your own personal story. So let's have you spill the beans here.
Well, you know, it's really interesting the relationship between law and what Kathy was talking about was her mother's situation. you know, there's something everybody's probably familiar with. It's called aging in place. Well, it's more familiar now than it used to be because as our population ages, obviously it's more of a concern. But for my family, with my parents, they lived in a split-level home. And my dad had had a stroke. And he was not able to get down those stairs by himself. Well, he could, but my mom was up in front of him as a buffer in case he fell. This was a horrible situation.
Knock her down, huh?
Exactly. She would buffer the fall. So what we ultimately decided to do was to move into a home together, a multi-generational home, so that we were able, my husband and I, were able to help provide care for mom and dad. So there is quite a relationship between you know, elder care, senior real estate, because, you know, what it's really about is aging. And where are you going to age? And how successful are you going to be where you age?
So one of the things that we talked with Becky Tiller yesterday from Tiller Care Strategies, who is a geriatric care specialist, and I guess what's coming to me is you got to think about this as a big package rather than just one piece here, the housing piece here, and the legal piece here, and the medical piece over here. So how do you think about this? I'll ask you both here. Mm-hmm. How do you counsel people to think about this when they get into this issue, knowing that either I've either got something imminent or I got a plan for it?
Well, that's the biggest thing that I think we all counsel people is the importance of being proactive and looking at the whole picture and coming up with a plan and knowing what your legal issues are and what your housing issues are and your medical issues and having all of that lined out. So if a crisis occurs, you are prepared for that crisis. You're not, you know, making your crisis even larger by having absolutely no idea what you're going to do. And many times it's the children then that have to come in and figure that out. So if you can prepare in advance, just the whole process is so much smoother.
I think, you know, one of the things that makes elder law different than, you know, traditional estate planning, for example, is the relationships and the focus that as an attorney we have with others in the aging community. So as Kathy was explaining, as you mentioned, it's just not focusing on one area of your life or another. There needs to be resources available. If you are dealing with an aging spouse or an aging parents, it's absolutely overwhelming. And you think, nobody's been through it before. I don't know what to do. There are no resources. And that's why we want to share the message that there are many resources available. So, for example, if you first came to Kathy about a housing issue, she would know others who can help this family, just like I, as an elder law, elder care attorney, would know other resources that this family needs.
And what I would add to that is very often through the process, my first conversation with someone who's thinking about selling their home is just asking questions and helping peeling back the layers of the onion, so to speak, to figure out what their needs really are. They might think that they need to sell their house because they need to move. But in reality, they may not need to sell their house. It may not be time for them to sell their house. And I know I'm a realtor and I'm supposed to sell people's houses. But very often I help them realize that they can stay in their home and age in place until a later date, because I'm able to refer them to people who can help them with that process. And that's huge. That's huge for them. It's a huge for their family.
Kathy Bryant and Lynn St. Louis are our guests. It's 10:15. And if they're here to answer your questions, if you have a call to 328-5877, or if you just want to send an emailed question to inlandjournal@kpbx.org, we've got plenty of time to take on questions. We were talking yesterday about, and as you were mentioning, you may not need to move out of your house, but where do you steer people to retrofit your house? For example, if you wanted to, you know, if you need to make the bathroom a little bigger to accommodate a wheelchair, or if you need to lower countertops and cupboards, how do you counsel people on that?
Well, I actually have a couple of really great resources that specialize in making homes accessible. So I would definitely get them in contact with these folks. The reason being is you might be able to find just a handyman who could do the job, but would they be doing it correctly? Would they be doing it to ADA standards? And that's what's important. You know, a ramp can't just go into the front of a house. It has to be done at a certain angle. That's certainly beyond my scope of expertise, but I know people who it is their expertise, and that's what's important is you get lined up with the right people.
So, Americans with Disabilities Act, are there questions regarding senior issues that you deal with?
Regarding the ADA?
Yeah. In terms of access, what sorts of things are legal in my house if I do something like that?
That's typically not something that we encounter with elder law. Typically with elder law, what we're looking at is people just trying to understand what do they need to have in place to protect themselves from a legal basis. I see the courthouse right out of your window here. It's a beautiful view, but most people don't want to end up having their affairs being open publicly at the courthouse. And that's really more of what we focus on is how people can take certain actions to protect themselves so that they have the right plan in place so they'll never have to worry about the court stepping in.
Okay. So I want to go back to your mom, Kathy.
Oh. Okay.
Just in terms of what's available out there, what kinds of things were you showing her that are available as a range of housing options for people?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because there's everything from totally independent living in a community or a condo or just an apartment where they rent. There's that. There is also the other extreme, all the way to what's called a continuing care campus, and that has independent, that has assisted, that has nursing care, it has dementia. And that way they can age in place in the same community. So everyone is not going to want the same thing, and that's why there's so many different options out there, and everyone can't afford the same thing. So it's important that you do that research up front to determine where you want to be and what type of environment you want to be in. Now, at the very beginning of this broadcast, you mentioned that article that I was in, and that, for those who don't know, is, I guess it was maybe six or 7 years ago now, I started getting this pushback from all my clients who said, I don't want to live in a place like that, and kind of in quotes. And I thought, well, what are they talking about? So I started this year journey where I spent a week, moved into 12 different retirement communities and saw what they were really like. And did all the activities and ate with the folks and interviewed people and came to realize that even though many of them offer the same thing, activities and food and one bedroom and two bedroom and studio apartments and shuttles, they're all different. And they all cost different things. They all have a different feel as you walk in the door. And that's why since then I have been such a huge advocate of people going out and doing the research now while they still can. I mean, if you're 70 years old and you don't have a plan and you have no idea where you're going to go, you're going to want to figure that out for yourself.
So you brought up the idea of cost. And so, Lynn, there's the question about if I can't afford some of the top-end sorts of things and I'm struggling to afford maybe some of the lower-end things, how can you help me to figure out how I can best use the money that I've got to leverage the best place I can get for mom or dad?
Well, to start off, we are not financial planners. But what we do know is elder law attorneys know the costs of care in the various communities, as Kathy mentioned, and we know certain requirements that the communities will have. Oftentimes, there will be a private pay period that has to be met before the facility would accept Medicaid benefits. So the planning in advance that Kathy mentioned is really important so that you don't wait until the last minute. Because if you wait until the last minute and all your money is gone, there are very few choices available to you. But if you plan in advance so that you know what's coming up, and nobody has a crystal ball, but nonetheless, we all do know that as you age, there's usually a decline in physical, sometimes cognitive health. So the planning process is what is the critical piece. And then we can help let people know, well, what kind of government benefits might you be able to access? Are you a veteran? Might aid and attendance come into play? If you're a couple and the cost of care is high, how would we be able to utilize Medicaid benefits? Because there's quite a misconception with Medicaid that the person has to be absolutely impoverished. And that's not true when it comes to couples.
So I want to be sure, does that also mean that I have to spend all of my assets in order to get Medicaid or any of the other government programs?
So no, not necessarily. It really depends on your marital status. A single person is truly an impoverishment standard. For a couple, the state has a policy against spousal impoverishment. And so what that means is that for a couple, no, they don't need to spend down all of their money. There are resource standards, but there is not a requirement to spend all your money.
We're with Lynn St. Louis and Kathy Bryant. If you have questions, 328-5877 is the number, or Inland Journal at kpbx.org. Listener question. So she's asking about, how can you best plan for senior living when you want to live near your child but recognize that child and the family may want to move someplace else during those elder years? What are some ways of attacking that one?
That's a challenge. But so the senior wants to live where their kids are, and that makes perfect sense. And I see very often where somebody will want to move from Spokane to maybe Bellingham, and their kids are still working, and they want to go over there and buy into a community. I might advise them that they don't want to necessarily buy. They might want to rent something just because their kids are still in that part of their lives that they're active and they're mobile and they're thinking about their process. So if mom moves over to Bellingham and buys something, and now all of a sudden the son or the daughter gets a promotion and now they're going to Portland, then all of a sudden she's over there by herself. Kids have moved on, and she doesn't have her support system there at all. Not only her kids are gone, but her friends that she used to play bridge with or go to church with, they're not there either. So it is something that you really, really have to consider pretty strongly.
So why do you ask the question, why do people stay longer in their homes? For example, if your mother wanted to, you know, stay because she loved her house, mm-hmm. she just didn't feel like moving was going to add to her quality of life. You know, why? How do you talk those people into the need to go someplace where they can better be cared for?
Well, first of all, I never talk anyone into the need to move. I help them try to determine whether it's right for them. But what I do is really help them see, are they staying out of fear? Are they staying out of the perception of loss of control? There's reasons like that people just don't even want to consider moving because it's the fear of the unknown. They don't have any idea what's out there. And because of that, they're going to stay put exactly where they're at, possibly much longer than they should. And so I kind of help them through that process of talking to them about is their neighborhood like it used to be when they first moved into that cul-de-sac, when they knew everybody in the neighborhood and watched their kids grow? Or has everybody moved now? Because that's kind of the cycle of life. I mean, people move and then they grow up and they move on. So are they there by themselves or are they isolated? They might want to think about moving into a community where all of a sudden now they can make some more friends and it's better for their life.
Sometimes they don't want to move because they're worried about how much it's going to cost. And we'll bring Lynn back into the conversation in terms of how do you talk with families about, you know, you really aren't going to be, you know, here's the way that you can save for it. Here's the way that you can make sure you get what you need. How do you do the long-term sort of planning with folks?
A lot of that depends on what their situation is in terms of their health. When people are healthy and independent, they're not even going to be thinking about that. So usually that issue is a forced issue because there is a broken hip and discharge from the hospital to a rehab facility. And the person can't come home to a house that has a split level. So they are forced to move. And if they've done the work in advance, for example, with Kathy, they'll know where they'd want to move. And then you can look at, well, how are you going to pay for it? Again, it depends whether what your resources are. Do you have long-term care insurance? Many people do not. So then they're looking at how are they going to pay for wherever they're at. It really depends. Are you going to be moving into an assisted living where the cost might be less? If it's going to be a skilled nursing facility, the cost is going to be more. Are you married or are you single? So the how you pay for it, you have to look at their particular situation. What are their resources? Do they have insurances? Where do they have to move to? And then we can, you know, help take a look at, are there any government resources available or are there not? The higher the cost of care, the more likely it is that the government resources can be accessed than if it's just a modest, you know, moving to an independent facility or an assisted living home.
So, Kathy, you talked about, you know, you should go out and visit some of these places. Mm-hmm. So is it perfectly okay to ask the questions that Lynn has just talked about to say, you know, I need to find out exactly how this is going to work or else, you know, we may not have to. What's appropriate and what's not?
It's appropriate to ask any questions like that. You want to find out what's it going to cost. You know, what's the process of moving from one part of the community to another part of the community? What amenities do they have? And here's a question that I found as I was spending that year. How long has the staff been around? What kind of turnover is there? A lot of times that has to do with how does ownership treat the staff, which of course trickles down to how are the residents treated. I think that's a big thing. Because that's, again, not the same in every community. I think it's huge that you take every single question you have and lay it out and find out the answers.
And then a lot of times people don't know the questions to ask.
Yep.
And that's one of the reasons that it's helpful to work with somebody who is in the aging community, because then you can ask. It's appropriate and should be asked, especially if you're looking at limited resources, is after what period of time will you accept Medicaid benefits? And it often is a 2-year private pay period. It can vary, but that's really important planning, especially if you're looking at, well, you do have a house to sell. That will get you through that gap period of time where you have to privately pay at $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month, so that you know that this is the facility that you want to be at. And once you've met the private pay, you'll still be able to reside there and not get kicked out because the facility will take Medicaid. So people don't know to ask those questions. That's why it's important to talk to somebody who does.
So what about in terms of doing your homework about the safety of nursing homes and other assisted care facilities? Because some of them don't have very good reputations. So can you counsel people how can I do homework so I can find out that you know, the staff is very helpful and wonderful to work with, or it's just not a very good place that you wouldn't want to put your anybody in?
One of the ways to do that, and there's you know, reports out there and websites you can access, but you know, things do change, and sometimes they change by month. So working with a care manager, care managers are people that are in the facilities every single day, and they can tell you, this is where I would put my mom, and this is where I would not put my mom. And so rather, you know, than putting a burden on everyone to go do your research, which is fine, do the research if you're up to it, but sometimes it's just trying to find the right facility. When I was looking for an adult family home for my mom, at that point there was 179 in the community. 17 of those would be able to give her the type of treatment that she needed, the insulin shots. And out of those 17, the care manager said, Lynn, here's the 3 that I like. Go look at those. I mean, that's invaluable to me.
Yeah. So 328-5877 if you want to talk with Lynn St. Louis or with Kathy Bryant. This is Plan Well, Age Well, Part 2 out of 4 today, talking about housing issues, talking about legal issues. And so let's go to a few of those legal issues. Toward the end of life, there are things that you probably are best to have in place, wills. What are some of the other ones that you counsel people that are kind of essential documents?
Well, it's really interesting because we can talk about towards end of life, what are the really important documents. But the caution that I have is if you wait until end of life to put into place those fundamental documents, you might have waited too long. So when you are at end of life, though, what's really important that you have is the durable power of attorney for health care. That's when you name your health care agent. If you can't speak for yourself, there needs to be somebody who does speak on your behalf. They have to be your voice. As important is the health care directive. And that's also known as a living will or an advance directive. And I'm sure people can recall back to, you know, the stories of people who didn't have them, Terry Schiavo, for example. And that's where you say, if you're at end of life and you're going to not going to be able to recover your, you know, permanent vegetative condition, do you or do you not want the heroic measures? And so it's important that you put in writing what you want so that your wishes will be honored.
So then are there different ways that different facilities will handle those documents? For example, we've heard horror stories of, you know, there was, in fact, I something in sort of my extended family where a nurse would do something that may not have been part of the person's wishes, thinking that they were doing the right thing, and yet sometimes it would make things worse. The family would get upset or all that. When you go and look at a place, what are the sorts of questions, are there questions you should ask about legal documents and how they handle different legal documents?
Well, one of the things is when you go into a healthcare facility, they'll, if you don't have your healthcare power of attorney and healthcare directive, they'll also often hand you one, which is the wrong place to be filling out a legal document. Again, that gets back to the sense of urgency. Do it in advance. When you're at a healthcare facility, it's always good to have somebody with you, an advocate, you know, the person that's by the bedside, because that way you're going to have a better chance at getting good care. So, you know, in terms of I don't know, Kathy, if you have anything to add about how to make sure that your care is going to be what you want, other than making sure it's in writing and you've named somebody to be your agent to speak for you.
Well, I know that at most of these communities, and I would probably say all of them, they require that the pulse is on the refrigerator. So when a fireman or a caregiver or anybody comes in and they see someone on the floor or someone in crisis, they know what those, and they take that with them in the ambulance to the hospital. Most hospitals, if you've been in the, you know, you have been admitted before, have that, and they keep that from one visit to the next. So that's part of it. But I also would go so far as to ask the administration, when you're thinking about going there, what do you do with this? Do you have a file that you keep, and how often do you review it? Where my mother lives, I know they just recently reviewed all of those. And by the way, my mom did eventually move into a retirement community, and she's been there ever since. And they recently did look through the files to make sure everything was updated. And she did change some things that she wanted different than when she initially moved in.
So you mentioned PULSED, Kathy, and I don't think we've defined that yet. That's a physician's order on life-sustaining treatment. That's not a legal document. You won't get that from your attorney. You get that from your physician. And that is lime green. It's very bright, very conspicuous. And that's what the emergency responders are looking for if you are a DNAR, do not attempt resuscitation.
So, and a question from a listener, friends and family seem confused, excuse me, about what a living will can actually achieve. And it seems most folks don't know anything about the PULSED, including those living at home. Do either of those have legal power in a nursing home? She says she was told by one that only a do not resuscitate order would be honored.
So if you look at the PULSED form, they both should be honored, and they should be consistent. So, but what is going to be looked at first is the pulsed form, because that's the doctor's order. If you are not breathing and 911 is called, you will be resuscitated unless there is, or they will attempt resuscitation, I should clarify that, unless there is a form that says don't attempt it. And so that is the why I call it the shorthand to the emergency responders to not attempt resuscitation. It's a different form than a healthcare directive, a living will and advance directive, which is typically has a lot more words to it. And it says, I don't want heroic measures if this or that. But the do not attempt resuscitation form is the pulse form.
So 328-5877 if you have questions for Lynn St. Louis or for Kathy Bryant when it comes to either legal issues or housing, or inlandjournal@kpbx.org. Now, a question about HIPAA rules, something we also asked yesterday, and what to do so that individuals and families can get information to participate in the medical care decisions with a family member. Are there things that you should do both at a particular place where you might be placing a mother or a father, or in a hospital or something like that? What are the things they need to be thinking about?
So HIPAA are the medical privacy laws. And in order for someone to be able to communicate with your physician, you should authorize that person to speak to your physician. So typically in powers of attorney, durable powers of attorney for healthcare, that language that says you can release information to my agent so that then they can speak with you. Those are part of an integral to that durable power of attorney document.
Okay. Are there issues with HIPAA in signing somebody up at a medical care or at a home facility or something like that? Is that something that is part of the equation?
Well, they have, you know, it's the law. They have to follow that just like, you know, any other medical community. So, okay. Yes, I would say that that's pretty standard.
Okay. So, again, if you have questions, 328-5877. So what are, if you don't have a will, and I'm 55 years old, and I'm willing to say that I don't have a will yet, what happens if I die? Just walk me through that sort of that legal, I won't use the word I'm thinking of, the legal situation you run into.
Well, it depends. And what it depends upon is what your status is. Are you married?
I am, yes.
If you are married, and then we take a look at, is your property community or separate? And then we take a look at if you had separate property, do you have children? Do you have children from another marriage? So it gets to be a very intense look at that nature of your property and your family dynamics. And with out a will, you're going to hope that the state is tracking with you on where you wanted your assets to go. And I can tell you that oftentimes where the state says they should go is not where the person wants them to go. So again, part of our mission is to empower seniors' voices. And so what that means is don't leave it up to the state to say where your stuff goes. In your will, you can say, I want it to go here and then to here. But the only way that you can be assured that that's going to happen is if you actually have an enforceable will.
And do I have to hire an attorney to do that, or can I get a form online and that'll be just as good as if I had worked with you on it? You're obviously going to tell me it's an attorney is best, but what are the options there, and what are the pitfalls and the benefits?
So there are many legal forms that are online, and of course the attraction is that they're online. You don't have to go see an attorney. Maybe you can follow the directions and fill it out correctly and completely, and so then you'll have an effective will. The lost opportunity with doing your own online form is that you receive no legal counsel about really what's important. And for people who are aging, usually what they really care about is protecting themselves and their spouse and their family and their money. And with an online will, you are not going to get those protections. So that's the difference is, you know, what we do is an estate plan to protect assets, and that's not a form. That is a plan, and that's guidance.
So there's the other, another term that I've never really understood when it comes to, and that is probate. What is probate?
Well, for most people, probate is a very bad word. They're scared of probate, and so I attribute that to very good marketing by those who want you to avoid probate. So let me explain what probate is. Let me demystify it for you. Probate is the legal process to administer your estate. Your estate is your assets. So upon death, the will is filed with the court. Your personal representative or your executor is appointed. Assets are distributed. Creditors are paid. And that is the end of the probate process. So probate can be a good thing or probate can be a bad thing. It really depends. If it doesn't benefit you in any way, avoid the probate process. If, on the other hand, it protects one half to 100% of your estate for your loved ones, then the probate process makes a lot of sense. So it's not a, it's bad or it's good. It depends what's your situation.
And it would probably behoove you to talk with an attorney beforehand before you get into that situation.
Well, especially before probate.
Yeah. So a question from a listener in Spokane. Are primary physicians required to discuss pulsed and the do not resuscitate forms with their patients?
That's a question that I don't know the answer to, what a physician is required to do. I do know that physicians will, and if they would discuss it, but it really depends on where the person is. If you're at end of life, if you're an 88-year-old and quite frail, likelihood is that the physician would have discussed it. But what if you're, you know, 38? I don't think the physician is going to discuss it with you absent some extraordinary circumstances that would suggest you're at end of life. So as in many things, I think it really depends on what is appropriate for the patient.
And speaking of appropriate, and I'm going to address this to both of you, and I think we've talked about it earlier, what is appropriate in terms of asking questions when it comes to interviewing an attorney or interviewing a senior housing person or a realtor in terms of what, you know, you don't want to appear to be, pushy or anything like that, but you have lots of questions you want answers to. What is appropriate in terms of finding professionals in these areas?
Well, because you're working with in real estate, probably for a lot of people, the biggest asset you have could, you know, from $150,000 up to $1 million, you want to know you're working with the right person who can truly guide you through the process. So there's absolutely nothing wrong. In fact, I would highly encourage you to talk and ask questions. It's an interview. It's not, you know, it's not a given when a realtor walks in the door that they're going to help these people. They have to prove that they know what they're talking about, that they know how to help them, that they know how to help them through the downsizing process, they have the resources, that they have the experience, that they really truly are a caring individual who will help them transition. But it's not just about that. Do they have the expertise on how to sell a home? Do they have the knowledge of what the market is like? There's so many things. Ask the questions. There's absolutely nothing wrong with talking to a couple of realtors and finding out, you know, who you think will be the best partner for you. Questions are always accepted.
You say the same thing, Lynn?
Yeah, I think it's very appropriate to ask questions. How long have you been in practice? What is your area of practice? You know, is it a general practice where you do real estate, family law, you know, a bunch of other things? Or are you focusing just on elder law? And then within elder law, there are subspecialties or subgroups within that. Certain people do more guardianship. Certain people, lawyers do more Medicaid applications. So I think it's very appropriate to find out the depth of knowledge by asking, you know, how long have you been practicing and how much of this type of work do you do? And do your research online as well. to, you know, see what the internet provides in terms of that person's reputation and credentials. So definitely encourage asking questions, especially when it comes to elder law. It's, we believe, very important that you're dealing with people who really what they do is elder law and not just a general practice.
So then back to Kathy, mm-hmm. you talked about you would go out and visit home facilities when you were doing the search for your mother. Is it appropriate? Do you just walk in, or is there a protocol for I make an appointment and go walk in, or can I just walk in at any time? What did you find was best?
Well, actually, you can do both. I would definitely suggest the first time you're there that you make an appointment, usually with the marketing director. They'll give you a tour around the community, talk to you about all the different amenities, help you understand what their community resources are. Let's say you have gone to two or three, and most of the time they're going to offer you lunch, you know, to sit down so you can have an idea of what the food is like, because food's always a big deal. And you've kind of narrowed it down to two places that you want to go that you think that might be a great community to live in. I say go in. When they don't know you're going in, walk in, see what the community is like. Talk to people. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, because then you get not just the pretty face that the marketing director is putting on, but the reality of what's it like for the people who live there. What does it feel like when you walk in the lobby and are people enjoying themselves? That's when you get the true picture.
And that's an expected part of the process from their end, too?
Oh, I think that they would be kind of surprised if you didn't do that.
Oh, okay. So we have a listener asking to say our guest names. We have Lynn St. Louis and Kathy Bryant, and also spell them. We can do that, too, in case you want to find them online. Lynn is L-Y-N-N, and then St. Louis, as in the city, S-T, and then L-O-U-I-S, and then Kathy Bryant, K-A-T-H-Y, and Bryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T. So if you have questions, we've got about 10 minutes left in the program, 328-5877. If you want to get in that last-minute question for Kathy or Lynn, or to inlandjournal@kpbx.org. Okay, what are some of the let's talk about Medicaid. We talked a little bit about that, and you've got a question in some of the questions that you've provided for us. What does Medicaid cover? Are you going to get much better care at a place where it's more expensive versus a place that takes patients on Medicaid?
No, the answer to that would be no. You might get better care, but then you might get worse care. Everything, I hate to keep coming back to this, Doug, that it depends, but it depends on a lot of circumstances. What I want people to understand is that Medicare, which everybody is familiar with, doesn't cover long-term care. What covers long-term care is Medicaid. So when people are hurt and maybe they've had a stroke and then they leave the hospital, they might need rehab. And if they've been in the hospital for three midnights and have been admitted and aren't under observation, then when they go to a rehab facility, Medicare will cover up to 100 days. But then if they're not able to return home after that, then Medicare will stop paying, and then you're looking at, well, how are you going to pay? And that typically would be Medicaid if you're eligible for those benefits.
This is assuming Medicare and Medicaid continue as they are right now, I suppose.
That's correct.
That's a political issue. That's
We
don't want to go down that road. So, Kathy, in terms of you becoming a senior real estate specialist, what did you have to do in terms of becoming a trainer? I'll ask the same thing on Lynn. What did you have to do in terms of extra training in order to become that as a realtor?
That's a great question. When I started the process of going down this road of working with seniors, I realized one of the things I could do is get my designation to become a senior real estate specialist. It's also referred to as SRES. And it's a two-day class, so 16 hours of study and, you know, kind of just barely touching on what is geriatric issues, what are they, how do you help someone through the process, what does it all mean, And so it just kind of, for me anyway, just kind of just lit the light bulb, so to speak, that there was so much to learn. And not all folks who get the SRES designation do this. But for me, if I really wanted to help seniors, I wanted to know more. And so I did my own education by working with and networking with all the different resources that I now have in my portfolio, that if somebody comes to me, I really truly know who I can refer them to. And that's part of what, you know, I think is important.
Is it becoming a more popular niche among realtors?
It is. It's, you know, it's a niche to be able, you know, we're all aging. And I don't remember what the statistic is. Lynn might remember how many of us turn over that spot, you know, every single day. But we're all aging, and there's more and more baby boomers, and there will be more and more opportunities for people. It's important to be educated in that.
And so, Lynn, do you have to do anything special to become an elder law attorney?
Getting back to what Kathy was saying, I think the term is silver tsunami, Kathy.
Oh, yes, that's it.
So I went to law school in the 80s, and there was no such thing as elder law back then. And as you know, Doug, as I explained, it was in 2002 when my father had the stroke that I started this journey of learning about elder law. So for elder law attorneys, what we do is it's a very collegial group. We share a lot of information with each other because Medicaid's laws are terribly complex, and it's not all written down where it can be understood. So what we do is elder law attorneys throughout the state have continuing legal education, and that's what I did. I went to every CLE I could possibly find, every conference. And that, plus my own personal journey with my parents and their VA benefits, their Medicaid benefits, is what really schooled me in elder law. So there are other credentials that people can obtain. They can become a certified elder law attorney, and that's helps tell the public that that's really what they focus on is elder law. But truly what it is what is your practice? Do you focus only on elder law? That really makes the difference, your day in, your day out experience with people.
So we have another couple of minutes for questions, 328-5877. One question from a listener who I'm not sure we have an answer for this one. Are there plans to increase the number and availability of ranchers, those one-story homes, as our population ages? And I guess that comes to the question of, are we finding more of there are more of these places that understand what seniors need, and so there's no need to have to worry about stairs and other things.
Yeah, I think that's a growing concern. There are people all over Spokane that are talking about building communities that are just strictly ranchers with no basements and two or three bedrooms, one or two baths, that really will help fill that need. I get calls all the time on that. I get a lot of different calls on senior real estate issues that relate to that, you know, the downsizing of where they're going to go, what they're going to do, and how will they move into a community.
Another question regarding housing, and we can extrapolate this one also to the legal. How does one go about finding a senior real estate agent in another community, for example, Olympia or Seattle? And we'll ask the same thing about finding an attorney in another, a senior attorney too.
Well, you can just go online, and you could, they're listed under, you can go under SRES.com, and you can find all of the realtors who have that designation. You can also find out who is a senior real estate specialist and who truly works with seniors, from attorneys that specialize working with elder law, geriatric care managers, doctors. All of the people who actually work with seniors will probably know a senior real estate specialist. For example, probably 90% of my business comes from referrals from attorneys and geriatric care managers and that sort of thing, because they know that that's what I do.
Go ahead, Lynn.
So in addition to the professional referrals, if you're looking for example, an elder law attorney and they're in Ohio, how are you going to find someone? What we tell our clients is call us. We will help refer you. But if you want to do it online, there's the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and it's naela.org. And you can put in the location, and then there will be a list of attorneys that are members of NALA. We similarly have in Washington, the Washington Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and you can go to that website, waela.org, and get a list of attorneys that are in Washington. In Washington, though, as I mentioned before, it's a very tight community of elder law attorneys, so any elder law attorney in Spokane can refer you to one in Bellingham or Vancouver.
But I like your idea, Kathy, and that is don't go straight to another realtor or another. Ask somebody else who deals with seniors who may not have a dog in the fight in terms of direct competition.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I want to thank you, both of you. We've got a couple of minutes left in the hour, but let's close by thanking Kathy Bryant, a senior real estate specialist, and Lynn St. Louis, elder law attorney. They will participate in a workshop. I know there's going to be more workshops this fall. Is there another one coming up in April here?
Well, we actually have a forum that is going to be next week at Corbin Senior Center at 5 o'clock on the 18th. And I would love to have that promoted through the rest of our seminars, because we want to be able to have people come to see all of us and meet us and ask us individual questions. A lot of times people don't like to ask questions online on the air. They might just want to meet us. And so we want to have them have that opportunity.
And good way to get a chance to get a feeling for whether or not if you're you seem like a very trustworthy person, and so I hire you for finding a place for my mom or my dad.
Exactly. So again, it's Corbin Senior Center, 5 o'clock on next Wednesday night at 8 on the 18th.
Tomorrow on Plan Well, Age Well, we turn to financial planning. We've talked a little bit about that, both for those of us in middle age and for younger adults. And we'll look at how the new federal tax law changes might affect your planning. Our thanks today to Stephanie Ingleby and Kathy Sackett and to Beth. And we'll be back tomorrow morning at 10 for Plan Well, Age Well here on KSFC at FM 91.9 Spokane, 100.3 in Coeur d'Alene, and KXJO FM 92.1 in St. Mary's. Thank you.